Is your business on its A game? It's when systems are intelligent, automation is effortless, and when technology and people work as one. The A game is your business at its best. BMC calls this the autonomous digital enterprise. You can find out more at bmc.com/agame.
Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Oh boy, we have a kind of a career show, what we're doing is we're talking to someone who is a real live, honest to goodness SRE, a site reliability engineer who works in a IT group that is very focused on DevOps and DevOps culture. That is, they're not talking about it. It's not a fashion statement for them. They are really into that world, and that is how they deliver applications for their business. They use DevOps. They lean heavily on folks that are site reliability engineers, which for some of you that are listening, that's like, ooh, the future. Well, it's not just the future, it's today. And James Quigley from Bloomberg is the engineer we're going to be speaking to. What stood out to you about our conversation with James, Ned?
The future is now, Ethan. What really stood out to me was the structure of the organization and the fact that he is not embedded with a specific team and DevOpsing. He is part of a specialty team that specializes in something that helps out all of these other application teams with their process and with their infrastructure. And I thought that was an interesting approach and a smart way to go about it.
Yeah. As we go through this conversation, we're going to talk about a lot of things. We touch on things as diverse as OpenStack and Kubernetes, as well as tools. Oh, which reminds me, that is a good reason for you to stay right to the end, because we are going to ask James about what tools, if we were to take everything away from him, he keeps, and what scripting and programming languages, if we take everything away, but he gets to keep just one, which would it be? So enjoy our conversation today with James Quigley. James, tell the nice people out there listening, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah. Hey, everybody. My name's James Quigley. I'm an SRE at Bloomberg, focusing on public cloud.
Nice. And to the point. So as an SRE dealing with public cloud, what are your main responsibilities? How would you describe that role?
I work on a team who's like a center of excellence for cloud knowledge, and we work on building the infrastructure and tooling to allow application and other infrastructure teams to develop against public cloud.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard the term center of excellence before, and sometimes that just means like POC. Like, we're going to do a little pilot, and then the team disbands after that. But it sounds like you've got an ongoing thing. How was that center of excellence founded? And how does it keep its motivation going?
I'm fairly new to Bloomberg and to this team. I just started a couple months ago, so I'm not too knowledgeable exactly about how my team was founded. But Bloomberg has wanted to start to invest in public cloud more and more. And so my team is kind of this ongoing team that is like points of contact for other teams that are going to be onboarding onto the cloud.
Oh, one of the reasons we reached out to you, James, to see if you'd be willing to record this is that DevOps is a big part of what you do in this SRE role. And I believe that's all part of this center of excellence and so on. So would you say DevOps in the Bloomberg context, is it a corporate culture or like it's a job title? You're a DevOps human.
Definitely culture. I've actually had the title DevOps engineer in the past, not at Bloomberg, but at other companies. And it's definitely more of the culture. The people are aware of that kind of dichotomy of DevOps not being a title, but of being a corporate culture that is just like working on continuous improvement and automation and enabling app teams to kind of self-service as much as possible.
Yeah, it seems in the folks that we've talked to, different companies, if DevOps is a culture, it has traction and seems to make more sense within the IT operations as opposed to it's a job title. You're on the DevOps team. The people we've talked to in that circumstance seem to give us feedback of it's the DevOps team and no one wants to work with us and it's terrible. So culturally, it seems to work better.
Yeah. I have the same exact experience. I mean, I think in the past when I've been a DevOps engineer as a title, basically anything and everything that had to do with cloud and IT and automation was just solely on, you know, the DevOps, the person, the individual. And there was no expectation of like the rest of the team, the rest of the company embracing that, the culture. It didn't exist there to work and focus on that as well.
Right. It seems like DevOps is really, it's a multidisciplinary thing with more than one role. So you can't be a DevOps engineer. You can be an engineer doing DevOps. Would that be closer to how you approach it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Now, within your realm of responsibilities, I come from more of the ops and infrastructure side, and Ethan does as well. And we've learned a little bit of scripting. We've gotten into that a little bit, but neither of us would call ourselves developers by any stretch of the imagination.
Nope.
Do you think of yourself as a software developer, or are you more just an engineer who knows how to script real well?
I would, actually. My background, I went to school. My major was software engineering. I did, coding and application development originally, but then kind of right out of college, jumped into the world of DevOps and operations. So I don't have the sysadmin background that I think a lot of people in the DevOps space do. I actually came from an application development background.
Interesting. And do you feel that's a hindrance in any way? Do you have to go to the crusty old sysadmins and bug them with questions? Or do you find it's liberating because you don't have all that baggage?
Both, I think, in some ways. A lot of the kind of like low level, some of the networking and, really hardcore Linux stuff that I just haven't had experience with before. Sometimes I have to ask questions about that or do some research. But I think it also helps me a lot because when it comes to some of the more consulting aspects of being an SRE where I need to interface with application teams, I have a lot of the knowledge that makes it easy for me to explain to them how to use the DevOps tools.
Okay, so you do think of yourself as a software developer, James. That's what you had by training. But same with me. Of course, my programming language training is 30 years old now, and we don't use those languages anymore. But right, that's what I started out doing as well. Do you generate software artifacts? Maybe that's a good way to put it. I mean, is there code that you're generating? This is a tool you've built or something along those lines that now other people in the organization are using?
Sometimes. That tends to be something that I do just like personally, but is not necessarily expected of me. I think most of the time here, work on this Terraform module or work on this Jenkins pipeline or whatever it is. But I've found that I can use some of that application developer background to make useful tools, usually for myself, and then share them with the rest of the team and hope that other people also find benefit with them.
Would you say that's primarily what you do? Like you're working on all of those things to make a thing that someone else is going to consume, or is it more on actually deploying things, building infrastructure with the tools, perhaps?
Probably the latter. Most of what I do is building, shared pipelines for CI, shared Terraform modules or patterns of documentation of how application teams can adopt some of these cloud tools and start to work in the cloud.
Do you have a template or a module that they can go check out and use, or a pipeline they can add their application to, and the pipeline will help build out the infrastructure that application is going to run on with sort of best practices and suggestions added to that, right?
Exactly. We want to make it as easy as possible for application teams to start working with the cloud without having to worry about some of the nitty-gritty details and best practices when it comes to security and scaling and robustness and stuff like that. So we try to take all of that into account, wrap that all into common modules, and provide that in a way that they can just easily adopt them and get going without having to learn every little aspect.
Right. You're the easy button.
That's the goal.
Okay, so I want to compare the way you guys are structured to the way a lot of organizations are structured. The majority of companies that I've worked for have been organized by technology silo. That is, you got the storage nerds and the security people and the network engineering people, those horrible people. Sorry, that's me. I'm a networking guy. et cetera. So siloed by technology. As you look at the organization that you're in now and maybe others, do you see similarities there, or maybe you're organized by business unit or in some other way? How do you look at your team and how the silos are built compared to that traditional way of siloing IT?
Yeah. So in the past, the companies that I was working for were pretty small. Frankly, not even big enough to have those separate teams. There just weren't enough people. So Bloomberg is one of the first organizations I'm really working for that has that size, that scale, where it makes sense to break those things out. And at least from the organization that I'm working in, it's really kind of broken out by business unit. But then there are shared teams that, like, much like our team, that are kind of like centers of excellence for what they're working on. So like you said, the networking, the security, the XYZ, that are kind of go-to points of contact for, you know, onboarding and then making sure that your team knows what you're doing.
Okay. So even though there's a DevOps alignment and culture, that hasn't done away completely with technology silos, in that you've still got people that are deep experts in a particular area of IT, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I think at some scale that kind of has to be the case. Being fully self-sufficient teams with no cross-collaboration from like squads who know exactly what they're doing. I don't necessarily know that it's super practical. I think it makes more sense to have a collaboration of like-minded people. And maybe you break out and you're embedding with your specific teams. I think it behooves everybody to have those people who know exactly what they're doing working together to an extent.
I mean, I agree with you, but that flies in the face of a lot of what you hear. It's like, oh, I'm a dev and I want to light up cloud stuff and I don't even want to care about the networking. I just want to have it magically happen, you know, kind of thing. I just want to consume a resource and have my app work and not have to worry about it. And I shouldn't have to worry about it. And sometimes you hear some of the AWS talks and they kind of make it sound like that's a way that it could be. Sure, it's so easy. You know, it's that way. And yet, if you are, for example, a networking specialist and dive into how various of the public cloud works, you do benefit from specialized knowledge about what's going on in those clouds because of some of the unique behaviors that happen as you're trying to plumb these clouds together. So I guess I'm not surprised to hear you say that, yeah, you do still kind of need to have a deep specialization. Although maybe there's a question mark that's raised there, Ned, because there's something that has come up with a lot of us that are practitioners. Do I become a generalist now in the cloud era? I'm supposed to know something about everything, or do I retain deep specializations?
That does actually lead me to the question that I wanted to ask is, you're the center of excellence, but that doesn't mean you can do everything for these teams that want to interact with you. So I'm envisioning, like, the structure of the teams that you interact with is very different than the structure of your team. So how are those teams structured in such a way that there's somebody that can take the artifacts and things you produce and then actually use them thoughtfully in the business unit or team that they're part of?
At Bloomberg specifically, they've kind of tried to really invest in the SRE model. So there are SRE teams that embed with application teams to help them use some of these artifacts, these pipelines, these all of these DevOps-y tools to make their lives easier so that the application teams don't have to worry about some of that nitty-gritty.
Okay. So, yeah, you've got these people that embed in a particular team for a while, and then as maybe that changes, they could embed in a different team depending on needs, or are they kind of with that team for the life cycle of the product that they're, or, you know, software that they're working on?
You know, I'm honestly not sure. I haven't seen that happen because I've only been at Bloomberg a few months, so I'm not sure exactly what the model looks like.
Okay. So let's say, let's take this from there's a new team that's forming. New team assemble, because we've got a new project that's going to kick off. It's some new public-facing app. You're going to develop it in-house and deploy it. It's going to run on the cloud. At what point do you get brought into that conversation? Is it when the team's first forming, or once they've got sort of a plan, but now they need some help?
Ideally, as early as possible. Sometimes, you know, happens that it's later than you'd like. But there definitely is a culture of reviewing, and making sure that, the SRE and infrastructure teams are aware of what is going to be happening, as early as possible, so that they can offer suggestions in terms of architecture design, optimizations, making sure that we're complying with all of, you know, security and all that good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Because like one of the things that I've seen in the DevOps movement is the sooner you involve other parties with the application architecture and design process, the earlier in that process they can point out things that are going to be issues later on when you actually try to deploy. And sometimes that's the security team going, oh, you can't do that. Don't you stop right there. You're going to have to do it a different way. Or sometimes it's the ops team saying that's not the optimal way to go about that if you're using the cloud. Is that the role that you're playing as the sort of infrastructure person who wants to get in at that ground floor and help with the architecture?
Not necessarily me personally, but that does exist, you know, at Bloomberg, where there are people who are trying to get in with the design as early as possible, and make recommendations. My role and my team, a little bit more specifically, is working on building some of that shared infrastructure, and making sure that those patterns exist, but we're not always the ones to push that onto application teams.
Right. You're not always the enforcer. That's what I heard you say. You're not making them do it necessarily. Yeah. Okay. So here's another, like a teamwork, how you guys fit into the big picture kind of thing. Let's say there's a major outage. This would never happen at Bloomberg, obviously, but let's say there was a major outage. There's a critical app. It's unavailable. A tiger team is quickly assembled and you're on that team. I'm making a lot of assumptions here, but let's say this is real. In your role, what do you contribute to the problem resolution?
Sure. So I actually haven't had the honor of being on call at Bloomberg yet, I've had this happen, you know, at past organizations. So one of the things actually in my last role, I kind of established an incident response pattern, because before that it was completely ad hoc. There was just totally free form, just like, oh, hey, something's happening, somebody jump on it. So some of the patterns that we tried to establish was making sure that there was a Slack channel that everybody was in. As soon as an incident was noticed, all communication went into that Slack channel so that there was a time log record of everything that's happening. Making sure that specific people are getting assigned to specific tasks, so you're not duplicating work or having multiple people doing troubleshooting solutions at the same time, and then following up with a postmortem afterwards, trying to always have a blameless postmortem going on after the fact, so that you can regroup, figure out what happened, share that knowledge within the team to try to prevent anything from like that from happening again in the future.
Blameless postmortems. I mean, don't you want someone to suffer and be embarrassed? Is that the way it's supposed to work, right?
Not me.
So here's a more pointed question relating with the outage stuff. So in various of these teams that I've dealt with over the years, you know, my role would have been as a deep specialist. Like, okay, the thing's down, so let's get some networking people on and some security people on and the web people on and, you know, maybe a developer or two, and see if we can't get down to what it isn't, and then maybe we know what it is, and so deep specialties would be relied upon to help figure that out. When you're an SRE, when you're dealing with tool chains, when you're dealing with kind of a different way that infrastructure is managed, do you have a different perspective on how you troubleshoot in a moment of crisis?
Yeah, to an extent. Our team, a lot of the kind of agreements that we have with application teams is that, like, the shared code that our team generates, these CI pipelines, the shared Terraform modules, if something's wrong with those, we're responsible for it. So we will figure out what's going on and fix that. But if it's something where your application is offline, but your application happens to run on the infrastructure that we created, that's not something that we're necessarily responsible for. We can help you figure it out, mm-hmm. but it's not our job to fix it if it's an application level concern.
Is it ever come up that, hey, if you just redeploy, since we've got this like standardized workflow and presumably golden images, the problem goes away? Or is it always more of, we don't want to pave over it, you know?
That, you know, the kind of off and on again, or just retry it methodologies work, you know, more often than not, honestly.
You know, in those moments of crisis where something is down and you need to bring it back up, sometimes people abandon process and just go and change things and fix things and, you know, just whatever they need to do to get it back up. And those changes sometimes accidentally get rolled back and then it breaks again, or they're not documented anywhere. What have you done, or what have you planned in your process to make sure that anything that happens in the crisis actually ends up back in the code, or at least reverted if it didn't contribute to the fix?
Yeah, almost, you know, everything we do is controlled via some sort of infrastructure as code, configuration as code, something along those lines. So if even during outages, we're you know, the idea is not to do everything manually. We're not trying to Wild West just admin credentials, go in and change everything manually. We want to try to stick to the process as much as possible so that you don't have those issues, that you're not going in and changing settings manually and then having them get overwritten by the next deploy, things like that. But I mean, I think in the case where you actually are manually going and making those edits, like you said, you need to ensure that everybody's aware that those are happening so that you can have action items to go and document them and add them to your code so that they don't get changed or overwritten.
Do you have someone during the crisis portion of things who's handling external communication? And I don't just mean with like the public at large, but also with maybe the higher ups within the org so that they don't try to come in and bother the people who are actively working on the problem.
I don't know. Yeah, like I said, I haven't had to experience that yet at Bloomberg, so I'm not sure what that looks like.
It's Ned. I can see you asking questions like that from memory, because I'm smiling and laughing almost every time you ask one of these additional questions about the crisis. Oh, I'm reflecting on different crises where, you know, too many people, especially at the managerial level, want to help, you know, and by help, they mean they're freaking panicking and they don't know what to do and they're not following the incident command process and they're given this engineer a directive to go check this and this other engineer go do that. And then the person who's actually supposed to be the incident commander is like, what is happening right now? No, stop helping. Go away. Please go away, et cetera. And it can really be a disaster if people don't follow the process designed to get you out of the crisis.
Yep. I was in a data center down situation several years ago, and we had that exact problem. The CIO and CEO kept pinging engineers asking questions and trying to get feedback and status updates from them. And we finally had to grab one of the PMs and say, you are in charge of these individuals. They are your point of contact. You just act as the buffer and give them constant status updates so they feel like they're doing something, and have them communicate out, and then let the engineers, of which I was one of them, get back to actually getting the data center back up.
Yes, managers and C-levels that are listening to us have this conversation. We know you're freaking out because the business is impacted if there's a data center down crisis like that, but resolving that problem is a deep work event for an engineer who's struggling through a very complex set of problems trying to get things fixed. And now we're way off the topic with James, and we should go back to James.
So sorry,
Ned.
James. Well, let's look at a different aspect of site reliability, because part of site reliability is making sure that it's up and functional. But another component of that is planning for what happens when things go sideways, which makes me think of disaster recovery. So is DR and business continuity part of what you plan for in your process?
Definitely. I mean, outages happen. It's just a fact. So you need to try to plan for that and make the decision about what makes sense most for your business use case. Like I said, we have these meetings to review architecture, make sure that application designs make sense. But part of that is the reliability aspect. Are you running in high availability kind of situation? Are you only doing one region? Are you doing two regions? Where are your backups going? Make sure that you've got, some of those things are assumed, that you've got backups, that you've got logs, that you've got security auditing, things of that nature. A lot of that's just baked in to everything that we do. But then some of the architecture designs is part of the review process that we make sure is being included.
Is there a budgetary component to this? By which I mean, you might have an application team coming and go, well, we need just 100% uptime. That's what we need. Are you able to push back and go, okay, we could do that, but it's going to cost you like $1 million a day. Is that okay with you? So is there that sort of aspect of it? Or can they just come in and lay down whatever, SLO they want?
Budgeting's definitely a part of it. Part of the process is making sure that they've gone through and ran reasonable estimates of what their infrastructure actually would cost them, so that their application teams can budget for that. But when it comes to reliability and uptime, it's really just a trade-off, because like 100% uptime is not a reasonable metric. You can't do it. It's just a question of whatever, how many nines are you going to have on your uptime?
Yeah.
And is adding that extra nine worth adding extra zeros to your budget? And that's a question that the business has to make. And if you're aligning to the SLOs, SLIs, SLAs, and you have this agreement that, whatever your percentage is, you don't necessarily have to worry about, are we up 100% of the time? Can we budget for 100% of the time? You just have to make sure that you're hitting that SLA. Hmm.
BMC wants to know, is your business on its A game? It's when systems are intelligent by learning from markets, where automation is paramount yet effortless, and when technology and people work as one in an enterprise. The A game is your business at its absolute best. BMC calls this the autonomous digital enterprise. You can find out more at bmc.com/agame.
Let's qualify the kind of infrastructure that you work on as we deal with these SLAs and reliability and so on. We've talked about cloud infrastructure. That's what we've mentioned, which I guess kind of implies to me a public cloud, typically. But is that what we mean in this case, James? You're dealing with cloud infrastructure like AWS, Azure, et cetera? Or are you also dealing with physical infrastructure that may be as hybrid cloud? Or is it both of those things?
So Bloomberg does own and operate their own data centers, but my team is specifically focused on public cloud. The ones you listed, AWS, Azure, GCP.
So maybe you have an opinion here. Do you see physical data centers, operating your own data centers, fading in favor of public cloud over time? Or is that just kind of a crazy dream we've all been having here the last 5 years or so?
I see both. I've worked at multiple organizations that ran their own on-premises hardware, and also worked for a couple who had no on-premises, infrastructure at all, and were 100% in the cloud. And I think, especially for large organizations, having your own infrastructure is maybe not a must, but it basically is always going to happen. Most large organizations have their own on-premise infrastructure. But there is definitely a push, at least from my perspective, of public cloud, of adopting at least a hybrid approach, moving a lot of the infrastructure to public cloud because of the cost savings, potentially ability to scale, things like that.
That was kind of my next question, is what's the driver then to have your own versus move to public cloud? Like, right, okay, move to public cloud. If you do it right, and there's a lot of caveats here, in theory, you could save some money. But as you look at why people would not go to public cloud and why you said, hey, you're probably always going to have your own, especially if you're a large organization, why would you keep things around?
Yeah, so one of the There's a really interesting episode of the Kubernetes podcast, different podcast. Sorry, I'm shilling one on yours. But they had an episode on the economics of basically cloud computing. And they had somebody on as a guest who was explaining that there's like a certain percentage of hardware efficiency, hardware utilization, and then labor efficiency that you have to hit in order to make it worth it to run on-premises at scale. So I don't remember the exact numbers. Actually, I have them here. You need to have over 60% utilization of your on-premises hardware and over 30% labor efficiency of those engineers maintaining that infrastructure in order to make it worth it to run at scale on-premises. So for a lot of companies, I think moving to cloud just makes sense because a lot of companies aren't hitting those metrics, that 60% utilization and things like that.
Yeah, in the past, I found that often people would get twitchy if you got over 50% utilization on the hardware because they weren't sure they'd sized things appropriately. And cloud sort of paves that over because it says it doesn't matter if you didn't size it appropriately because you can just get more and you can get it more immediately. And that's a pretty big difference. Now, one thing I'm curious about is because I'm sure you interact with the physical infrastructure team, even if you're not part of it, have they started to move to a private cloud operational thing so they can get that 30% efficiency?
As far as I know, yeah. I think they're working to use tools like OpenStack to make sure that we have kind of like an agnostic framework for building infrastructure, whether or not it's on public cloud or private cloud. But I also know that Bloomberg has adopted Kubernetes, fairly early adopter of Kubernetes. And there's been some case studies that have been published for the data science team at Bloomberg. We were able actually to get over 90% hardware utilization using Kubernetes for their data science. So there have been some really good gains there.
So I'm going to be a child and ask, did they run Kubernetes to keep OpenStack up?
I couldn't tell you that, but I think it was more for scaling and making it easy for the data science team to run their, use Kubeflow to run ML models and stuff like that.
It's interesting that there are different projects that OpenStack has a use case for, because it's funny, even that as that project has matured, you just don't hear about it as much anymore because there aren't constant new releases and new things happening. It's just there's people running it. They're running it quietly. You don't hear much about it. And Kubernetes is the new hotness. Everybody's excited about that when you're doing something with Kubernetes. But I just want to qualify what you just said there. In the Kubernetes related projects that you're talking about, you said, again, 90% hardware utilization using Kubernetes as the orchestrator to bring it to manage that that hardware in that cluster.
Yeah, at least specifically for that that team, that application, the data science team that had going there, they were able to achieve that level of utilization, which is really impressive.
Although I think a part of that's going to be not just Kubernetes, it's going to be how the application was architected, because Kubernetes is only standing up containers and so on. So there is an implication there. The app was able to be used by Kubernetes in such a way to get that level of utilization.
Yeah. Definitely. But Kubernetes does help, since you can pack, instead of having one VM and then one application running on that VM, you're able to pack a single VM with as many containers as the orchestration system can fit in there based off of their resource requests. So it's not necessarily a thing that if you use Kubernetes, you will see these massive gains in utilization, but it can help, especially by using it.
Brett, I think of sort of the fact that if you were running VMware before, it had an orchestration component that would move VMs as needed and also try to spin up things. But you were limited to the size of a VM, which is much bigger than the size of a container. So you've shrunk down that unit of expansion, and now you can kind of plug it in all these places where a full VM might not fit anymore.
Yeah, and throw automatic, like horizontal auto scaling into that, and cluster auto scaling, and now it makes it a lot easier to try to always operate at a higher level of utilization than, you know, normal. Like you said before, Ethan, that people were, you know, balking at 50% utilization. Now you can have a much higher percentage threshold be your normal.
Right. So since we're on the Kubernetes train, I'll just keep going with that a little bit. It sounds like you're running it on premises. Are you also running Kubernetes in the cloud? And if so, are you doing it in a managed capacity using something like EKS or AKS, or are you sort of managing your own clusters?
Yes to all of the above.
Okay. All right. So why would you choose to use one of the managed solutions versus building your own cluster?
Mostly, I think it's just because we don't necessarily want to have to spend the time to be cluster operators. If you can use one of these managed services, you still get a lot of the benefits of using Kubernetes, but without having to manage and operate the control plane, which can save you a lot of headache.
Right, sort of the same reason that you use cloud, because you're not responsible for the control plane. What would be a situation where you would build your own cluster instead of going with one of the managed services?
I think we're moving a little bit more towards defaulting towards a managed service. And I think for, most of the cloud services in general, we want to use an option that will be at least an equivalent is available on other clouds. So trying to avoid vendor lock-in to an extent, but as long as there's an alternative available on a competing cloud, that's okay. And if there's not, then we'll probably use an open source or run our own.
But that's interesting because in a certain degree, Kubernetes has been held up as the panacea for multi-cloud. Oh, look, you want to do multi-cloud? Well, you can do Kubernetes everywhere. But then you look at the managed versions, and sometimes they do weird things. So I could see wanting to run your own if you really want that true multi-cloud experience.
Yeah, there's nuances with all of the managed services that can make it difficult to have this truly agnostic framework. With EKS, even just like the authentication scheme is integrated with AWS IAM. That's something that's different than other versions of Kubernetes that you run yourself or with the other managed services. So it's trading off. How much vendor lock-in are you comfortable with?
We were talking to some folks yesterday, and one of them made the point, Kubernetes is the wrong choice in almost all circumstances, but when you need it, you really need it. It's really the right thing. Does that sound about right to you, James?
I don't know if I would go as far as saying it's the wrong choice in almost all circumstances, but I do think it is probably being a little bit over-prescribed at the moment, that a lot of applications don't need the crazy overhead of this orchestration system when a simple, VM with an auto-scaling group or even just like a single machine or just like a group of machines and high availability will do the trick. You don't necessarily always need the containers. When you add something like Kubernetes, it's not simple. It's not a simple framework. Yep. It's very complex, and the tooling around it is complex. And so you're adding a lot of overhead just to the mental model of how everything's working alongside the actual complexity of, running your application like that.
Huh. You mentioned vendor lock-in, and that's definitely a concern, whether you're in the cloud or on-premises. So I imagine some of your tooling is mostly open source whenever possible. I'm curious, are there some tools that you use that are proprietary that you just stick with because they're so effective, or are you pretty much using open source tooling across the board?
I'm trying to think of all the tools I use on the day-to-day, but I most of them I think are open source. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the orchestration system, like Kubernetes and Docker and things like that, are open source as well. And so the tooling, a lot of it's not proprietary because it's also open source tooling. They're not necessarily like vendor provided solutions.
Do you think vendors are getting things wrong with their products when it comes to being DevOps friendly? That's a pretty loaded question, but...
Yeah, it is. I'm not trying to bash on any vendors either, but I mean, one pain point I always have, I found like when learning a new tool, using a new vendor, is everybody wants to focus on their documentation, which is fantastic. Love it. And they always have a really great getting started. And it's like, okay, here's how to get started. And you're going to run this in a single node locally with no authentication in an insecure manner. And you're like, that's great. I've got it running locally. Now, how the hell do I scale this up to a production grade thing? And there's just this massive gap between okay, I've got it running here and I need to run this in production. And the gap between there is just gone.
Oh, you're speaking my language, James, because this has come up for me numerous times when trying out a new open source software. It's like you're getting started, you're hello world, and then you look at the rest of the documentation and it is deep in the weeds of advanced use cases. And there's just this tremendous gap between the hello world and running it full bore in production across 12 clouds with 100 nodes. Like, give me something that's like 201 level. That just gets me, okay, how do I get this thing to be moderately secure and running in one cloud with a little bit of HA sprinkled in? Can we just do that?
Yeah, I love it. You got to love it when they include in the documentation too, like, oh, this is not meant for production workloads. Like, don't do this in production. And it's like, well, then what should I do in production?
Right. It seems, and actually write docs as one of my side gigs. So this is near and dear to my heart. I think one of the things that I've been told several times is you have to get the developer or the engineer, whoever's trying this out, up and running as fast as possible. If they feel any friction, they're going to flake out immediately. And I don't know if that's true or if that's just something the industry has decided on. This is so off topic, but I'm curious what your feelings are on that. Do you need to be up and running with a new product within 20 seconds? Or are you willing to put a little more work in to get something that's not just completely dev and open to the world?
I mean, I don't think it hurts to be up and running really fast. But at the same time, as long as I can believe that there is value in that tool, that I will get value eventually if I'm going through your getting started guide, I'm willing to put in an extra couple minutes into getting it going properly. You know, at least personally, I don't know that I can speak for everybody, but I would rather have it be a little bit more complete than to, you know, just paste this command and everything will get going, but it's only going to work for you locally and not have any guidance on production.
Right. So, James, we thought a good way to close out this interview would be to ask you some tooling questions because, you know, baby, you're right in the thick of all these things. So let's say I'm going to take away all of your open source tools except one, and you get to pick which one it is. Which one do you keep and why?
You know, I think actually thinking about that, I would probably say Terraform. I use it a lot. I'm a pretty big fan of it. It's something that I've leaned on all the time for in past roles, current role, personally. Just makes it really easy. Their documentation is actually pretty solid. You know, when we're complaining about docs, they have some pretty good examples of everything. And I use it all the time.
Yeah, Ned doesn't like Terraform, but I'll do you, Ned.
No, not at all. Never heard of the thing. Don't know why anyone would use it. I wish I had the coffee mug to hold up right now, but it's upstairs. Oh, that would have been perfect. So, okay, so that's the tool you chose. Mm-hmm. Follow-up question. I'm going to take away all of your scripting and programming languages, all the ones you use, except one that you get to keep. Which one do you keep, and why is it Bash?
I do write a lot of Bash. That's true. You know, my answer actually probably is not going to be a popular one, but I actually would probably say JavaScript or TypeScript, just because that is the language that I've got the most experience in, that I've used the longest, worked with the most comfortable with, which, you know, from an ops perspective, I'm sure is not the popular answer. But I would just be the most productive with that, either that or Go probably.
Well, you just said something really important there. This is the language that I can be the most productive with. This is the thing I have the most experience with. So I think in some cases, there's this battle between what's the latest language and what's the coolest one, or what's the one that everyone else is using. And that's like the one you're supposed to use. When in reality, the language you can get the most done with in a hurry, because you've got the most time into it, you got the most experience, maybe that's the right answer for a lot of folks. And we're obsessed, and when we shouldn't be, about which language it is.
Yeah, right tool for the right job. You want to make sure that you're picking what you can get the job done best with. And sometimes that's the, you know, language that nobody else in the world uses and you feel like you're the only person using it. But sometimes you want to lean on the community, or you're going to be building a new team if you're hiring, then the lingua franca for the day is going to, you know, make sense if you're getting on the hype train to onboard people who actually want to work with the language. If you're going to pick some, you know, outdated language that people don't like, then it's going to be difficult to hire. But for me, I would so much rather pick something that I am comfortable with and can work with well than to pick something that I am going to make a ton of mistakes with when I'm trying to actually get the job done.
I mean, it really is too bad you picked JavaScript and TypeScript, but I mean, you know.
Well, no, I think it's fantastic, James, because now when I have a question, I know exactly who to ask. So you really just raised your hand for me. That's fantastic. I've been struggling with some Node.js stuff, and I'll be calling you after this. Just
so you know. Sure. You can hit me up. Okay.
Well, James, this has been a fantastic conversation. We've really enjoyed chatting with you today. If you could leave the audience with some takeaways, like key points about being an SRE, about DevOps, anything in that world, what thoughts might you have for folks?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say that your job, the goal as an SRE, is to make life easier for application teams in terms of getting their application up and running. But then it doesn't stop there. You need to make sure that you're adding self-service options for all of their tooling. You want to make sure you've got your monitoring, your alerting, your logging, your disaster recovery, business continuity. You're trying to continuously improve your processes and everything around it to make sure that your application and your business is doing the best that it can.
Boy, that is actually a major thing, because so much time there's friction between the operations side of the house and the dev side of the house, but you're looking at this as a relationship. Your job is to make life easier for application teams. That is not adversarial. That is a complementary relationship.
You're on the same team. And if you're not delivering product, if you're not delivering value, then your business isn't making money and you're not going to keep your job. So you're wanting to make that a friendly relationship and making sure that you're helping everybody else be productive.
Yeah, great stuff and great points that you make there, James. James, are you a social creature? I mean, I think I found you because of something you wrote. So if there's a Twitter handle, blogs, maybe you wrote a book, James. I don't know. Anything like that you'd care to share with people so that they can follow you, please let them know.
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind me shilling, you can find me on Twitter. I also have my own blog, blog.quigley.codes. I also got a YouTube channel where I've got a handful of Kubernetes and other related content on there, so you can find me on all of those places.
Very good. Thank you very much, James of Bloomberg, James Quigley from Bloomberg, for chatting with us today about being an SRE and DevOps and all that stuff. This is a good cultural conversation, and this is, we really enjoyed this. It's insightful because there's a surprising number of organizations that are still stuck in the past, is a harsh way to put it, but kind of that way. So it's nice to hear what your experience is like working in a group that's been organized in a more forward-thinking way, leveraging public cloud, leveraging, gosh, all the checkboxes of what's going on in public cloud, including Kubernetes and even OpenStack, All right. Well, thanks to you for appearing on Day 2 Cloud, James. And hey, if you're listening, virtual high fives to you for tuning in. And if you have suggestions for future shows, we would love to hear them. You can hit Ned or I up at Day 2 Cloud Show. That's on Twitter. Or fill out the form at Ned's super fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. And if you'd like to interact with the IT community some more, join the Packet Pushers Slack group at packetpushers.net/Slack. It's free. It's like 1,300 people in there that are all nerding out about various things, networking and cloud and so on. And we'd love to see it. Just go ahead, sign in, and obey the rules. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.